Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 1st of July. First hour of the program today. Yesterday, American troops left Iraqi cities. And by August 31st of 2010, 14 months from now, all combat troops will be out of Iraq. By the end of 2011, all American troops will be out of Iraq. Yesterday's New York Times editorial said there's an enormous amount to do and not a lot of time to help Iraqis prepare for the withdrawal and to reduce the chances the country will unravel as American troops leave. What needs to be done? President Obama said yesterday that the Iraqi people are rightly celebrating this as a cause for celebration, which they did do yesterday. But also the future belongs to those who build and not those who destroy. Make no mistake, Obama said there will be difficult days ahead. And at a news conference, Odierno charged that Iran was continuing to support and train militants in Iraq who attack U.S. and Iraqi forces with rockets and roadside bombs. There will be a small number of the more than 130,000 U.S. troops who will remain in the cities as trainers and advisors. And the military has said it will continue to provide intelligence, air power, medical, and logistical assistance to Iraq's 650,000-member security force. U.S. troops will go back into the cities only if they are requested to do so by the Iraqis. Joining us to talk about what's ahead for Iraq, we have two guests this hour. Professor Charles Tiefer is a professor of law at the University of Baltimore. Professor Tiefer, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And also joining us is Professor Judith Yaffe, who is a distinguished research fellow at the Institute for National Strategic Studies at the National Defense University. And Professor Yaffe, thank you very much for being with us. Hello?
Yes, I can't hear you.
Oh, there we go. Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can. I'm delighted to be with you.
I forgot to press the button, so that could make for you not being able to hear me. Thank you so much for being with us. So let's start with the difficult days ahead. The president warned of difficult days. We've heard warnings of an uptick in violence. How difficult a transition is this going to be? You want to start, Charles?
Sure. The president's correct to try to lower public expectations. Indeed, recently there's been more bombs being blown up, killing Iraqi civilians than for a while. There's a certain sense that the Iraqi sectarian violence, which hasn't been occurring nearly as it was a couple of years ago, might revive as American troops are pulled back, and the two sides, which check their guns at the door for a while, grapple for who's going to take over.
Mm-hmm. And your predictions of the days ahead, Judith?
Well, we're seeing an upsurge of violence now. That's true, but whether what is sectarian based or what is political party interest based, there's a scrambling for influence, for control, for power. There are a lot of issues as to who controls what and who's going to shape the new Iraq. So it all contributes to a certain unease. It is natural for Iraqis to be delighted. We're gone. And as Maliki, the prime minister, says, we beat them. We got the occupier out. Now, that's great rhetoric, and no Iraqi is going to support anybody who says less than that. Having said that, there is great unease on what does it mean as the Americans draw down, because the last time that happened, when we left and went left the cities and went into our fortifications, our bunkers, that's when the violence really rammed full speed ahead. But at that time, back in 2003, 2004, 2005, you didn't have a central government that could function in any capacity. So things have changed. There will be violence. This is not going to be a simple thing. And it's not as clear like, yeah, we're glad you're gone, but don't go yet. Mm-hmm. I think that's about the best way to characterize it.
Right. Well, my understanding, and tell me about this zone, there's some kind of a bunker zone that's just 10 miles away from Baghdad where these troops are going to go, and if called on, they'll be there ready to help?
They're supposed to be outside the cities. Now, you have to define what is the city from what is outside the city. They can be called on by the Iraqis should they need help. And there are certain activities that we're allowed to conduct in terms of the war on terrorism against Al-Qaeda. We need their Iraqi government's permission, but there are things that are in our legitimate right and interest to do. But basically, we are working with the Iraqi government. We just can't run out and do whatever we want. But there are some missions that are very much that we hold in common. There's some things that we're going to do on our own.
Mm-hmm. Charles, tell me about that Iraqi security force. Is it up to speed?
It hasn't been fully tested yet. There are several possible problems with it. To some extent, Iraqi soldiers have always wanted to be protecting the country against external threats. And another problem with it is the remaining division between Shiites and Sunnis. One thing that will be standing the Iraqi troops up is that we are keeping even after the complete pullout of combat forces, we have, as Professor Yaffe said, 50,000 who are there as trainers and advisors. And it's been speculated that they may continue training and advising the Iraqi troops if they're in combat, which means that the legacy we have of the since 2003's invasion may not come to an end, even supposedly when all combat troops were withdrawn. Mm-hmm.
If I could just add to that, there's two levels here. There's one of the national army, the military, the armed forces, and then there's the police. On the armed forces level, the Iraqis have made better progress. On the police, a lot of problems, a lot of it controlled by warlords, local politicians, very much militias, former militias, very, very self-centered. But the point I wanted to make is that Maliki now has a force within the military that reports only to him. He calls it a counterterrorism unit. It draws on all components, and it is apparently functioning very effectively. They did manage to quell the violence in Basra and in Baghdad. So they have some impact, but the question I would simply raise here is, what's the mission? Mm-hmm. Who do you want to do counterinsurgency? What's the role of the military? Do you want them running around in the streets doing what in effect would be police work in any other society or time? And that's where the Iraqis were probably not on board because of the history, and the reality says the police aren't ready to do.
Mm-hmm. Let's spend a little bit more time talking about these various populations. The New York Times had an interesting editorial, lengthy editorial yesterday on Now What? And they talk about the issue of Sunni populations being shortchanged on services. Baghdad hasn't carried out a law allowing former members of the Ba'ath Party to return to their positions or to collect pensions. We've got the Kurds who essentially are running, their own place up north. How are those divisions, those resentments, likely to be taken care of? How can they be taken care of?
Who did you want to address the question to?
Who wants to take it? Charles, you want to start?
Okay. Yeah, that's the Times is right on target there. Since the government, both Maliki and for that matter their legislature, are dominated by Shiites, and the Shiites were sort of kept down, maltreated during Saddam Hussein's time. They want to strengthen their hand, the Shiites, and so they are not giving to the Sunnis what the Sunnis would want. And that, remembering that the oil income is crucial, and the Sunnis feel they're not going to get their share of oil revenues. They're in the position of thinking that the only way to protect themselves might be to resume their large share of the insurgency.
I would add to that, there's a lot of unanswered issues, and some of them have to do with the sects and some don't. Oil issue, for example, and who's going to be in charge of development, signing contracts, redistributing the wealth. that's something at issue, which especially between Baghdad and the Kurds. The Sunnis may be upset because they don't have oil. I find it hard to believe that there's an area of Iraq that doesn't have something under it. So I think in a way it feeds into a larger argument as who is the supreme authority in Iraq? Is it the federal government in Baghdad, or are the provinces stronger than the central government? The way the Constitution is written now strengthens the provincial authorities and keeps the central government weak. This is what I think Maliki and the centrists are trying to change. It certainly is to the advantage of the prime minister, the central government, and by extension, of course, the Shia, since they are the majority. Now, by majority, that doesn't mean they may be the majority of the population, maybe about 55% to 60%, but they at best got in the mid-40s in the election. They don't always vote for themselves. But the point is deciding who gets what. And I would, just add another layer, ministries in Iraq are not owned by the prime minister. So far, they have been, in effect, parceled out to different interest groups. Some might say sold to the highest bidder. But they're not functioning with the national interest or much else at play. This has got to be changed. Maliki has what we call here the kitchen cabinet, which is his own advisors for each area, and that's where he tends to go for advice on making decisions. Does this have to stop? Yeah, but they're a work in progress. They're at the very beginning of working out these different relationships. The Sunnis feel that they're lost because the Shia government or the Shia minister doesn't want to spend money in their area, or vice versa. Right. It almost goes without saying, but the federal government, Baghdad, had made certain commitments to the Sunnis because of their role in defeating the Al-Qaeda, the Sons of Iraq, that we encourage and train. They had made a commitment to, of that 100,000-strong militia, to bring in at least 20% into the security services and military, and the others would go into the government. They have maybe only taken in 5% at best. They don't. They stopped paying salaries for a while. We had been paying, and now they're paying again. But there's a lot of questions as to where they're going to go. Do they want to do it or not? As Maliki has said, what you Americans did was, in effect, you've saddled me with another militia. Militias are supposed to be banned. You're arming a potential opposition. Now, that thought is still pervasive, and you have to get the Iraqis beyond that, and I don't think they're there yet.
Right. Well, let's talk about what each of you think might be best here. Is a strong central government the way that Iraq has to go, or would there be something wrong with having strong provincial governments that could somehow cater to the needs of the different groups?
Well, I think you have to ask yourself, what does federalism mean? Because they talk all about it, but nobody agrees on their, and I don't think there is a common definition. But if you think about our Constitution, there are certain powers and obligations that reside with the federal government. We had a civil war to settle that, right?
Mm-hmm.
There are other obligations and rights that belong to the provinces. They have to sort that out. When you have the national wealth and a history of oil being under federal control, under government control, that was nationalization of oil was very, very popular when it happened. And the Iraqis don't want to move away from that. They don't want to. There are quite a few Iraqis, not just the Sunnis, who see that every step to the provinces is a way of breaking down and ultimately partitioning Iraq or, you know, destroying Iraq. They don't want to see that either. And I think even the Kurds have a stronger buy-in now to the unity of Iraq. But everyone wants it on their own terms.
Mm-hmm. Charles, what do you think is best?
I'd say the key problem is in having for Iraq to stay together, for that matter, even if Iraq didn't hold together, is the division of oil revenues. Professor Yaffe is right that since Iraq has either the second or third largest oil reserves in the world, there would be, if they were developed enough to go around, and then if there was an agreement that the states or the areas that are Sunni, which are the ones where current oil isn't being gotten, if they got a share, then that would make them content and would completely, not completely, but significantly lessen the pressures for partition. And there's some benefit. I think the Shiites in particular would like to have the power to implement not a total theocracy, but more their kind of Shiism. So they'd like that, and they'd like to set up such a state. That's why you might have at least a strong regional government if the Sunnis will get money. And the other thing is the Kurds, which is, as Yaffe mentioned, they consider themselves in many ways virtually autonomous, and I don't think they're going to reduce that autonomy anytime soon.
Let's welcome phone calls for both our guests. Our number is 800-486-8655. Yesterday in Iraq, American troops withdrew from cities and will be withdrawing from the country within the next 14 months, all American troops, by 2011. There will be advisors in many areas there until 2011. Our phone number for you to talk about this transition is 800-486-8655. Do you think that this is proper timing for the U.S. to begin withdrawal? Some are saying that why not bring them home at this point in time? Richard Clark was saying that on a show I was watching last night. And if you'd like to send an email, you could do that. That is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org, or 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Our guests are Professor Charles Tiefer, who's a professor of law at the University of Baltimore, and Professor Judith Yaffe, who is a distinguished research fellow at the Institute for National Strategic Studies, National Defense University. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, Archbishop Rembert Weakland will be with us to talk about his new book, A Pilgrim in a Pilgrim Church. So that's coming up, hour number two. All right, to your phone calls. Mike from Brookfield, our first caller. Hi, Mike.
Hi, good morning. I guess my comment is the oil fields are mainly in the south and central Iraq, I believe. But in order for the oil to move, it's got to move through pipelines to get out to the north, I think towards Turkey. And, the Kurds and the Sunnis, I believe, control those pipelines. Why don't they just derive their revenue tax for every barrel of oil that moves through their pipelines, and that's how they would derive the profits or the revenues from the oil fields in the south?
They're not really arguing over the distribution. Actually, they seem to be rather satisfied. It has to do with who decides who signs the contract, where that money comes from that pays for the contracts, and who benefits. And they're arguing over the new oil. Now, Iraq has very rich fields in the north, but they're older, and it's harder to get the oil out. And as you point out, Kurdistan is landlocked, so it has to depend on cooperation from Turkey and other neighbors, maybe Syria. Certainly a lot of oil goes out through Iran, but it has to depend on that for export. Now, they do make money from all kinds. There are all kinds of transit fees and everything else. But essentially, they need to build new pipelines. They need to build. They need to do exploration into the new fields, and they need. And what they're putting a top priority on is repairing the old oil fields. That way, they'll be able to realize a profit quicker because it's easier to repair something than it is to start all over again. But the other thing I'd point out is that doing work on oil fields in the north is harder. In the south, it's very easy, and the oil is that sweet stuff that everyone puts a high price on. So you're right, there's problems, and I'll add one more level. You can have pipelines all you want, but if they can't get out through the Gulf, and that's becoming increasingly difficult, then they have problems getting it out. Iran is more than happy to cooperate and build pipelines and refineries, but I think the Iraqis are reluctant to put all their eggs in that basket.
Mm-hmm. And tell me, I'm a little confused on this topic. Tell me, Charles, if you know, or Judith, What about other international oil companies, American companies, British companies, Russian interests? How are they going to play out in Iraq's oil future?
Well, just yesterday they held an auction to see for bidding on which oil companies would help repair the oil fields and start production up. And only one of the bidders was American ExxonMobil.
Hmm.
And there was Shell was in it. Royal Dutch Shell was thought of not so much an American company. All the other bidders were, as you mentioned, there was a Russian bidder and a Chinese bidder, and the contract went. The bid that was accepted, the only one that was accepted, went to a partnership between the Chinese and another. There is a great suspicion of letting American companies in, making terms easy to let American companies in, because there's suspicion in that the Iraqis, among other things, believe that the war that was started in 2003 was because Bush wanted to grab their oil fields. There's also suspicion of the Americans because after all these years in which supposedly America was doing reconstruction, supposing the Bush administration doing reconstruction work on the oil facilities, as Professor Yaffe said, there's very little to show for it. As fast as we did repairs, and one of the big contracts to do those repairs was the so-called Rio contract held by Halliburton, KBR. The facilities would be blown up somewhere else, or the repairs turned out to be done in the wrong place, or a waste of time. So we're lucky that they were even willing to allow ExxonMobil to bid.
Let's go next. Thanks, Mike, very much for your call. Bill from Tomahawk is next. Hi, Bill.
Oh, hi. This kind of leads into my question, and it is, given the cost of maintaining the military and mercenary armies that the United States has in Iraq, why isn't partition to our advantage, since it's our aim to withdraw forces and mercenary forces?
Professor Yaffe?
Well, I'm not sure why you think that partition would enable us to bring home all the forces. Everybody would be happy. The Kurds may have as their dream an independent Kurdistan, but the Shia don't want a Shia stan, and the Sunnis aren't interested in a Sunni stan. The identification there tends to be very much as a united Iraq, an Arab Iraq, an Iraq that can have Arabs and Kurds in it, but they don't want to see any kind of partition or division. If anything, the Kurds' insistence on all forms of self-rule, with the threat of if you don't play the way we want, we're going to go home, we're going to withdraw, that's simply bringing the Arabs together even more so than they might. It's hastening that process. The Arabs are not comfortable with the claims that the Kurds are making, and they just passed a new regional constitution. They have a lot of claims on land that they don't control now. It's not just Kirkuk, which they're fighting over, but there's other cities like Mosul and other areas involved. And the point is, none of that is settled, and it's what, in my own mind, creates the nightmare of the real civil war. But this has never really been an option on the table. It's been in the minds, not even of the Kurds, but of people who I think are very pro-Kurdish and have even more ambitions in that direction than the Kurds themselves, who are very clever and realize that to ensure their security and their protection, they have to deal within the system as it is.
And thanks very much for the call. Professor Tiefer, we've been there for 6 years, which seems to me is a fairly long time. What do you think? Has progress been made there? Was it 6 years spent wisely? Are things, because of our presence, likely to be better in Iraq?
That's a fair question. I would say that the first couple of years after we went in, 03, 04, so much damage was done by the policies of Rumsfeld and Jerry Bremer, who headed the occupation regime, that the remaining years have been spent getting back to where things were. And so we went. You could say Iraq went down and then got back up, and it's not a lot higher. In some respects, it is, but oil production is not particularly higher than it was before we started. There was an intact Iraq army, which the Bush administration disbanded in 2003, a huge mistake. So with great difficulty, we're trying to recreate an Iraq army. There was a debathification, which in the radical way it was done back in 2003 by the Bush administration, basically threw out of most of the ministry's experts because they were at the lowest rung of the party. So we've been trying to rebuild the ministries. And Professor Yaffe noted rebuilding them means sort of each ministry is belongs to one of the political parties. That's my view.
Mm-hmm. If I could just add to that, 6 years is not really a long time. It is to us because we've only fought wars that, 4 years and no longer? But those are false comparisons. You don't make the kind of changes that we wanted to make or that the Iraqis themselves wanted to make. You don't make those in 6 months or 6 years. It probably will take a generation for a lot of the things that are problems and, hatreds and bad ill feeling and revenge. It's going to take a long time to work through that. The Iraqis themselves, I've heard say, it'll take at least 15 years. 15 years is the lifespan of a military career normally there. So if you think about it, this is a long-term process. Iraq is a work in progress. And I would also point out, we made mistakes, no question. And we don't have to go into any of that now. But it was also, for all the work and all the work that I did when I was in government on Iraq, Iraq was a country that was devastated by war, by Saddam Hussein, by sanctions, and this had been true since 1980. How do you, we, as close a watch as one tried to keep on it, we couldn't estimate how much damage had been done, and we did not go about the reconstruction properly. How can you explain why does it take 6 years and you still don't have power 24/7?
Right.
And you still don't have clean water everywhere?
Mm-hmm.
One can explain it, but it's kind of inconceivable.
Yeah, it is inconceivable. Yeah. And what about American guidance? If you say this will be a generation, should we be there in some capacity offering guidance, help, material support, et cetera?
Sure, why not? We've got expertise and we've got technology, and it's valued. It's not saying that the military has to be there forever, but I think that Iraqis and we see that there are areas we can contribute to that they would like to purchase. They would like to be involved in education. If you look at we signed two agreements with them in November. The one that everyone's focusing on is the one that's in effect now, the so-called SOFA, Status of Forces. You will draw down, your military forces will be gone by such and such a date. There was a second agreement called the Strategic, I can't remember the second part of it, Strategic Alliance maybe, or agreement, but it was an outline for what relations would be between the state of Iraq and the United States of America, and it has to do with economic cooperation, educational, all kinds of areas where on a civilian and government-to-government and person-to-person basis, we can contribute, they can ask. And that, I think, is a very good thing and a very positive thing.
Professor Tiefer, what role America in Iraq?
Well, there's what we have to do and what we wish we could do. I think especially if violence resumes anywhere near the level it was recently, then the 50,000 American troops kept as advisors and trainers would be there a very long time, and a fair amount of American sentiment would be that we don't want to continue to see the statistics of Americans getting killed, American soldiers getting killed there. and the large amount of money, that the billions or tens of billions we're going to have to spend there. It's not as though you'd think, well, gee, the Iraqis have all this oil, they're going to have more, they can pay for the cost, they could reimburse us, but the Iraqi capacity to even spend on their own operations is quite limited. Their ministries can't manage. It's called execution, meaning they promise to spend a certain amount of money for their own benefit, let alone for anything to do with us, and they can't do that. So they're weak, both military and civilian sides, and we're going to be in there much longer than we want.
Our number is 800-486-8655. We're talking about Iraq, American troops leaving the cities yesterday, celebrations in Iraq when that happened, and what needs to happen at this point to make the country safer, to restore electricity and to make sure people have clean water, schools are up and running, people feel safe going to those schools. We have yet to talk about refugees, too. There are some 4 million people who left Iraq. Will they return? What about the brain power that has left Iraq, and do those people need to return to help rebuild the society? Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Frank from Madison is our next caller. Hi, Frank.
Hello.
Hi.
Marvelous guests, as usual.
Thank you, Frank.
May I ask two related questions?
Sure.
One is, and they're both naive questions, is it possible and is it feasible for Iraq's neighbors to be sponsoring a confederation in Iraq? That form of government would sort of possibly defuse the tensions between the different groups, and a larger Iraq nationalism could emerge, given. And then second, is it possible for a central government, a weak central government, to be the fairer redistributor of oil revenues, which would also be a defusing situation? And then purely as a comment, the result of the first Gulf War was the creation of Kurdistan, something that wasn't on the books prior to the first American invasion. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Frank, for the call. Professor Tiefer, want to start?
Well, I'll return the compliment. The callers, like Frank, have been asking excellent questions. Talk about the first one. There was a thing called the Iraq Study Group, bipartisan, that a couple years ago argued strongly to the Bush administration that the way to calm things down and hold them together in Iraq was exactly what you were talking about, get the neighbors to buy into stabilizing it. And the reason they would find it in their favor is, in fact, the two. If Iraq goes deep into sectarian violence, then instead of being held together, you're going to have a proxy war in which the Shiites, who are of the same religion, though not of the same ethnicity, as Iran next door, the Shiites would have Iran as their backer, and on the other side, the Sunnis, who are of the same religion as Sunni as the as Saudi Arabia, would have Saudi Arabia, among others, as its backer. And these are the two great regional powers, and the idea of the two of them fighting a proxy war is really scary. So one would, on the other hand, the two could say, we hate each other, Saudis and Iran, but we don't want actual warfare to break out between proxies. And then they could become the stabilizing factor that, Frank, that you asked about, and that the Iraq Study Group was looking for.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's an important question, and I was one of the advisors to the Iraq Study Group. And to my knowledge, it never recommended that the neighbors do what could only be described as interfere in what was going on inside Iraq. The issue was really to get the neighbors to stop meddling inside Iraq, to stop funding the parties that were feeding the insurgencies, feeding the violence and the sectarian unrest. Now, is there a role for the neighbors? You bet there is. And that has a lot to do with helping the Iraqis to maintain border security and stability and not be funding and feeding the conflicts inside Iraq, which are not necessarily on a religious basis. This has a lot to do with tribes. And a lot of the tribes that are, especially the Sunni, but also some of the Shia in Iraq, came out of the Arabian Peninsula, or exist in Saudi, in Jordan, in Syria, as well as in Iraq. So there's a lot of that kind of cross-border interest, which allows the Saudis to encourage and support certain groups, and the Iranians have a big hand in there. And I think the point from my knowledge is that the Iraq study group was to say nobody should be meddling in, but you can do a lot to cooperate. The other thing the Gulf states could do, all the neighbors, if you have a vision of where you want Iraq to be, a friendly, non-threatening, unified, you know, somewhat stable government, then help them to get there. And they're not willing or interested in doing so. They're not. The Iraqis want to be treated as an equal. They were a power once there. They want to be that again. There's a lot of animosity or dislike or distrust of Iran and what it's doing, especially among the a lot of the Shia, who should not just be written off as because they're Shia, they're pro-Iran. But it's a complicated issue. The assumptions are being made about this, but the reality is going in a different direction.
General Odierno yesterday at a press conference was saying that Iran was continuing to support and train militants in Iraq with rockets and roadside bombs. I'm wondering about, considering the chaos going on in Iran right now, we thought there might be a diplomatic door open. It's hard to imagine if there is now. Maybe there is. But what will Iran do right now? How do we have any influence with Iran in terms of trying to get rid of their support for terror in Iraq?
Yeah, that's everybody's question today, I think. But the point is, the proxy war that people talk about going on inside Iraq is not Saudi versus Iran. It's the U.S. and Iran, and that we're both using our surrogates to conduct some kind of proxy warfare. Maybe that's true, but I don't think so. But I think it's the kind of thing that Iran is very worried about. And the question is, given what appears to be a certain degree of instability in Iran, at minimum, what they're going to be able to do outside of the borders are scary. I'll tell you what I worry about, though, is that every revolution, every government under this kind of internal domestic stress, there's one sure way to bring support, to rally the people around the government, and that's an outside threat. What are those Americans doing in Iraq? Or there's a threat here, and we've got to focus on that and be nationalist and loyal. And that tends to move everybody's attention away from the kind of internal conflict that has that is so dividing Iran.
Mm-hmm. Professor Tiefer, what do you think about that?
Well, the Iranian activity is not just what General Odierno was talking about. A major party in the legislature, in the government, was basically set up by Iran, that consisted of people who were exiles to Iran under Saddam's regime. They have militias to go with them, and there's always been some fear that what will happen after we leave, however much we drag our heels, is that the pro-Iranian party and pro-Iranian militia might resume fighting against a weakened Sunni equivalence, opposite numbers. So the Iranians, and the more, and we have never is a strong term, but we've thrown away opportunity after opportunity, both all through the Bush administration, to reach some kind of an understanding with the Iranians, who in fact were grateful that the United States knocked out Saddam Hussein. And might have also didn't like, they also don't like the Taliban in Afghanistan for good measure. But that's the fear going forward, we missed our chance, and now you might say the violence in Iran means the chance isn't there for a while.
Mm-hmm. More phone calls in a moment on the Ideas Network. The second hour of our program today, former Archbishop, Milwaukee Archbishop Rembert Weakland will be with us, and he'll be talking about his just-released book, A Pilgrim in a Pilgrim Church. There's a lot to talk about with the Archbishop, and we're happy to have him with us. Okay, continuing, our guests for a few more minutes now are Professor Judith Yaffe, who is a Distinguished Research Fellow at the Institute for National Strategic Studies and the National at the National Defense University, and was an advisor to the Iraq Study Group. Professor Charles Tiefer, Professor of Law, University of Baltimore. We're talking about celebrations that took place in cities in Iraq yesterday as American forces leave the cities, and they will be leaving the country, combat forces, in about 14 months. So that's what we're discussing. And here's our number if you'd like to join the conversation, 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you. Our email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'd like to ask our guests about the number of people who have left Iraq. I've heard reports as many as 4 million people have left, and that in order to rebuild the country, engineers and teachers and a lot of people left because of, obviously, safety concerns. What about their coming back? Do people need to come back to Iraq? Was there a big brain drain?
Sure. There was a big brain drain under Saddam and a huge one. Now, there are about 2.5 million Iraqis who are living as refugees outside the country. And there's another 2 to 2.5 million who are internally displaced. In other words, they have had to move around. They can't go back to their homes. Now, should they be able to do that? Yes, but only a very small percentage has tried. They can't go back to neighborhoods. They left because of ethnic cleansing, of threats that, you know, you're a Sunni in a Shia neighborhood or a Shia in a Sunni neighborhood, you've got to leave. The Kurds did a lot of de-Arabizing areas around Mosul and Kirkuk. So you've had people on the move who can't go back because of the threats. Other people are in their houses, and who's going to help them get that back? It's a slow process. There is a claims court mechanism which exists, but it's guns and militias that have been forcing a lot of this issue, not going to court to sue for your property.
Hmm. Professor Tiefer?
They certainly do have a great need to bring back their professionals. What America has done for them, pouring about $22 billion in the narrowest form of reconstruction, physical reconstruction, is not going to be sustained going forward. We're going to turn out to, like, pouring. The nickname for some of those facilities is stranded whales in the desert. That's what the Iraqis call them. And what's needed are professionals. What's needed is engineers to come back and help with the facilities, and as educators and so forth. So Iraq was not like a primitive country. That's a strong term, nasty term. But Iraq was at a much higher level of education and development than Afghanistan when we went in. And so we're still trying to get back to the level that things were when we invaded.
Let's go to Bud next. Hi, Bud. You're on the air.
Yeah, I think your guests are slightly misrepresenting the real purpose of the Status of Forces Agreement. Its primary intent, and we have SOFAs in place in many, many places around the world, is to protect our troops from outlandish litigations or imprisonment. That's the primary reason. The second reason is associated with basing. The drawdown of troops is incidental and was not a factor in the SOFA. Also, for your male professor, your Bush bashing is apparent. Recall that we have troops in France, Germany, Italy, Korea, Czech Republic, Poland. Most of those were from the Second World War, which ended in 1945. The Korean War ended in the 50s. That's all I have.
All right, Professor Tiefer.
I will say Bud is not just giving an opinion. His facts are worth discussing. Pretty solid. I think you were the one who mentioned there were two deals done at the same time. The strategic one and Professor Yave, you were the one. The strategic one and the SOFA, and you couldn't get one without the other. So technically, it's true that the SOFA does hear what status of force agreements do throughout the world. Although it did do some special things for Iraq. Starting from our CPA, our occupation regime in 2003, our civilian side, the personal security people, had total immunity in Iraq for whatever they did, and the SOFA put an end to that. There hadn't been anything like that in absolute immunity. So that's one of the things the SOFA did. As far as it's true that those agreements function similarly throughout the world, but where we have bases, there isn't open warfare going on, and so this SOFA has a lot of heavy lifting to do that other SOFAs don't.
Thanks for the call. We go next to Marie from Appleton. Hi, Marie.
Professor, you mentioned a possibility that Saudi Arabia might go to war with Iran, and you called it a proxy war. What is a proxy war?
I did not say that there was any possibility that Saudi Arabia would go to war.
No, the other gentleman did. No, he didn't say it would happen. That was if the... No, nobody said it would happen. The question is, what is a proxy war?
Proxy war is where outside powers feed, encourage, support internal groups to fight. Iran has a proxy in Lebanon, Hezbollah, which has fought for it and not always listened to it. We have had supposedly several proxies. Sometimes Sunnis blame us for supporting the Shia. Shia blame us for supporting the Sunni. But the point is outside groups support the activities these operational activities by groups that are fighting inside the country.
Understand.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. And we have time for one more call. Carl from Peshtigo. Hi.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi, Carl.
I want a yes or no answer with this question. Do we have a military base started in Iran amongst the oil fields for their protection? I'll take a yes or no answer and elaboration.
Not to my knowledge.
No, we do provide the kind of support, among other reasons, but the answer is, so you wanted a yes or no. Oil fields, no. Pipelines, yes.
Thanks very much for the call. I want to go back to something that both of you have highlighted. It seems to me as though after 6 years, you ought to be able to get some of these basic services down. It's hard to exist in a country if you don't have clean water, and it's hard to exist if your lights are coming off and on. Why is it so hard for the government to accomplish these basic services?
They have gotten a lot of basic services done. First of all, the power thing is not 24/7, but a lot of Iraqis have generators that when the regular power goes out, those generators kick in. Now, they have to pay for that, of course. There is water that's good in certain parts, but it's not uniform. This is not countrywide. There are accusations that a lot of this kind of money has gone to favored areas over non-favored, there are all those things. But the point is, I think a lot of it has gone on very quietly. There has not been a lot of attention drawn to the successful completion of these projects, in part because as soon as that was done, you had insurgents blowing them up. So you don't know anything about the success of, say, sewage or water in many areas. The problems are not all countrywide. Some places have different problems than others in different degrees. But it's not like you live in the United States and the power's always there and the water's always there.
Mm-hmm.
It tends to come and go. And right now the weather is so hot. It's at least 125 degrees.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it's just incredible. So you can imagine the drain that puts.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, my. Thank you both so much for being with us. Our guest this hour, Professor Judith Yaffe, Distinguished Research Fellow, Institute for National Strategic Studies at the National Defense University, and Professor Charles Tiefer, a professor of law at the University of Baltimore, for being with us today, responding to the withdrawal, beginning of the withdrawal of American troops from Iraqi cities that started yesterday. By August 31st of 2010, all combat troops will be out of Iraq. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for on-air production. News ahead, and we'll return with more conversation here on the Ideas Network.